They seemed to know Acock, for he was kindly welcomed. Nobody welcomed me, however. Acock spoke animatedly to them. Since I could not understand anything, I confined myself to watching his gestures. He often turned to me, probably explaining who I was. Now many came up to me and stood around me with astonished faces. One stood out from the group and greeted me by placing a hand on my shoulder. I bowed, and gradually the group dispersed. Everyone took his place again. I sat down with Acock at a table to which we were directed by the man who had greeted me. I assumed that he was the owner of the hotel. Acock pulled a paper out of his pocket and handed it to our companion. He stamped a picture on it and I saw that it was the same document he had shown to the overseer at the agricultural workplaces. The man handed it back and Acock pocketed it. All present looked at us curiously. Acock said, "You must be hungry now." "Me? I don't yet TMT know if it's time to eat or not. I've lost all sense of time." Acock laughingly shrugged his broad shoulders and said, "It's time for the third meal. It is now noon on Earth." "Yes, I know you have already explained this to me. But it just seems odd to eat so many meals here. It seems like a joke to me." "I think that's funny. The same thing happens to us when we're on Earth." Now the food came. I waited for Acock, as always, to say a prayer, but as soon as he spoke, I asked, "Why is no one praying here? You only do that at home. Why then?" "When so many people are together, you cannot pray to the Creator unless you are alone or with your own." "Yes, that's actually true." We did not talk until the end of the meal. Then he said, "Let's go. You have traveled enough for today. Will not we continue from here?" "No, I flew with you today to show you as much as possible of Akkad. If you have seen and heard enough, we can fly back, and I can give your decision to the Son of the Sunday. Will he resent me if I no longer want to see and hear any more?" "I cannot answer you, but he would be happy to hear that you would like to see more of Akkad." "But I didn't TMT say I did not want to see anything anymore. On the contrary, I thought we should go further." "Good, then let's do that. I seem to have misunderstood you." "Fine, later TMS go on," I answered. We took the elevator up to the terrace, got in and were in no time 40 to 50 kilometers away from the hotel, but still over the city. Again, the whole city was embedded in rock. He pointed to a hill and said, "Let's go there now." 13. The Solar Steel Factory. We climbed a little higher and finally arrived at the place designated by him. From this height I saw something very surprising. I asked, "What's that, an airfield?" "No, that's one of the factories I talked about." "A factory, here? Do not you see that this is part of the roof of the factory I mentioned?" "Yes." At that moment he made a turn, and I found his answer confirmed. The factory was about 10 kilometers long and at least 500 meters wide. What he had called a roof was a vast, smooth, sheet of metal. It looked like an airfield. I started to laugh out loud. Acock heard it and asked me why. "Oh, just like that," I said and continued to laugh, because it had occurred to me that in Brazil the whole nation would have to pay for 2 years if such a metal sheet were to be made there. We landed on the metal roof ourselves. There were thousands of such ships as the one we came with. New craft kept landing, but none flew off. I asked, "Why are they just landing, and none are departing?" "Because they are all starting work now." "Do the workers come by in such flying machines?"
"To work?"
"Yes, they all commute with these craft. If they don't your TMT live close by." "Are the workers here so rich? Such an apparatus must cost a lot of money."
"No, it costs nothing. Every resident of Akkad who works has a right to such a ship."
"I do not understand." "You learn to understand it before you return to Earth." "Let's go," he said, without giving me any further explanation. I followed him as always. We went to an elevator and went down to the ground floor. Incidentally, this giant building was only one story. There is no need to say I stared, on leaving the lift, because everything was a novelty to me. The first surprise started when I saw very few columns supporting this huge roof. I had expected thousands,
because I could not imagine that without such a large roof would not collapse, especially since there were also thousands of spaceships. As I said, the building was about 10 kilometers long and 500 meters wide at a height of about 30 meters. I saw only three rows of columns, one on each side and the third in the middle. They stood at fairly large distances from each other. We went to some rooms at the far end. They seemed to be offices about 30 meters to the left of the elevator. If you wanted to walk from one end to the other in this building on foot, you would certainly need 4 hours. As I thought so, I automatically went through an open door with a cork. There were several departments on the left side, on the right side. Nothing seemed to be particularly interesting. A cork headed for a long, wooden office table where several people were reading through files. A fat man with the manners of a boss approached us. A cork also showed him the well-known document. The man read it and gave it back with a smile. There was again a lively discussion. The fat man looked at me from head to toe. I was probably the topic of the conversation again. He handed A cork two square-shaped, hand-sized pieces of paper attached to something. They talked for a while, and A cork said, "Come with me." We left. The fat man spoke to the other people who had continued to work, but now they looked at me with a frown on their face. Before we entered the elevator, A cork handed me one of the papers and said, "Keep this safe." "Why?" I asked. "This is a permit to visit the whole factory. Without this card we would have to explain to all sorts of people." I put the badge in my breast pocket and felt very big with it. I had looked at it before, but of course I could not read anything. I did not even find a comma in the writing, but only worm-shaped signs. For 2.5 hours we walked through the factory. To be able to render everything I've seen, I should need to be an engineer, a chemist, a draftsman or something else. The training that I have enjoyed unfortunately does not allow me to recount the details. I can only approximate what I saw there. If I really could give a detailed description of everything I saw, I would have a book of at least 500 pages with 150 illustrations. We started sightseeing now, walking through an iron and steel warehouse with sheets and bars for the first 200 meters, and shortly afterwards saw different machines at work. "What was made here?" A cork told me, "This is mainly home appliances, televisions, electric ovens, and much more." As I passed, I could tell that they were very different machines. After walking about 1,200 meters, we entered a room where all the products of these machines were stored. They were stacked up to the roof, some parts were still on the ground, ready for final production. All the machines worked in perfect harmony. The first worked on the raw material, what had been created went on to the next, etc. What the last machines worked on was ready for use. Thousands of items were made here every hour. We crossed this part of the hall with the finished products and returned to a machine shop. "What is being produced here?" I asked. "This is the Department of Electrical Appliances, where everything that has to do with electricity, lamps, motors, weapons, etc. is made." I looked at him in disbelief, because that must have been a joke. Electric weapons. I could not understand this. I assumed he would confess his mistake, but I was the one who was wrong. I wondered why weapons should be manufactured in the electrical sector, or was there just electric power on a cart? "What is the function of these electric weapons?" "You will see for yourself." We continued through the factory. The machines of the next section seemed to be smaller than those of the first, but there were just as many. I was very surprised that I saw this machine shop in full production mode. I noticed that all the work was going on electrically, but still I could not see any wires with which they could have been supplied with electricity. On closer inspection, I noticed that the wires came out of the floor. Now the matter was clear to me, and I did not inquire further. After this machine hall there was another storage room, similar to the first. I saw the thousands of engines that were stored in this sector that was devoted to engine production. Many were so large that they reached across the width of the factory. The length was often almost 1,000 meters. Between the individual engines were only narrow passages. But I also saw engines no bigger than a lamp and generators weighing several tons. Acock led me up several steps to a warehouse. It was about 200 meters long and full of objects that resembled hand drills. At least they looked like they could be operated by hand. In one corner of the warehouse were the smaller ones, in the middle a little larger, and in the end they were as big as a 10-horsepower engine. "Look," Acock said, pointing to something that was like a lamp with two elements. "What kind of a device is that?" I asked. He smiled and shook his head as if to say, "You are wanting, poor earthlings. How far behind are you?" "This is a weapon for personal defense." I did not know what to answer because I could not find anything to load that weapon with a bullet, and after some deliberation I asked, "Where are the bullets loaded in and where do they come out of?"
"Bullets. Out?" he laughingly replied, "The age of bullets is long gone."
"Well, but how?" He interrupted me in the middle of my question, looked about him, pulled the passport out of his pocket, tore off a corner of it, threw it on the ground about 3 yards away, and aimed at it with such the device. From the small weapon came a strong beam, similar to a blowtorch. I expected a detonation or the impact of a bullet on the ground, but there was nothing to be seen but this noiseless ray of light. But there, where the bit of paper had been before, there was only a heap of ashes left, from which a light smoke rose. I was quite stunned and asked, "Did the ray of light accomplish this?"
"Of course, did not you perceive it?"
"That's fabulous. How does that work?"
"With batteries?"
"No, with solar energy. This apparatus produces rays of about 200 volts. They cannot cremate a person, but they kill him immediately." I pointed to the larger appliances in the cupboard. "These are probably stronger?"
"Yes, much stronger."
Acock put the small apparatus back in its place. We were now standing in front of the cupboard. He showed the individual models and gave their strength. The last he showed me were quite large, but the operation was the same for all of them.
"What are the bigger devices for?"
"They are installed in the sunships. A ship like the one you came here in is equipped with 8 to 10 such weapons."
"How powerful are such weapons?"
"It's very powerful. Using it, you can destroy a house at 2 to 3 kilometers distance."
"That's horrible."
"Maybe, but the atomic bombs you have on Earth are much more dangerous. Comparatively, our weapons are like children's TMS toys. This weapon is not very effective if you want to attack an enemy with it."
"Surely they can only be used as a defensive weapon against a nearby enemy?"
"For such a case, we have other, much more effective weapons, but they are not meant to attack the Earth's population, I imagine."
"What weapon is that?"
"The neutralizer."
"How does this weapon work?"
"It can neutralize the sun's rays to a distance of 5 kilometers. The whole area under the influence of such a neutralizer is then without life and can no longer be controlled by the enemy. If there are living things in this area, they will die of suffocation in a few seconds."
"Does that mean that a spaceship that enters such a neutralized zone is not destroyed itself, but it kills its entire crew?"
"The spaceship would be lost too. When it is no longer under control, it races with tremendous speed in empty space. If it collides with the surface of a planet, it would be smashed into 1,000 pieces. With such a weapon, you can probably end a war in a few minutes without destroying a single house."
"Weren't me correct?"
Acock said and sighed deeply. "Are these neutralizers made here, too?"
"No. There is only one neutralizer factory on Akkad and it is not here.
Maybe I can still take you there, so you can understand it. I would be very happy to see this wonder weapon of the Akkadians."
"I suppose we are now in the middle of this factory?"
"We are not that far yet. We came to a kind of iron foundry. There were molds everywhere. I could see that the skeleton of the small flying machines was made here. I had seen the engines lying in the electrical parts department. This sector between foundry, machinery and ship hulls covered an area of 500 by 2000 meters.
Acock explained clearly which piece this or that component formed. I could follow his explanations well, since I had recently flown in such a machine several times. It was fantastic to see all this going on in sequence, When the raw material was processed, it went to the foundry, then to the assembly machines, and finally the little spaceship was finished. After seeing all this, and after Akok had gone to great lengths to explain everything to me, we went on. It really was miraculous what the technically and scientifically advanced people created here. 14. How an extraterrestrial spaceship arises. In the next section, Akok led me to rotundas that looked like swimming pools but did not contain water. They were round and bowl-shaped, at the bottom measured their diameter about 30 to 35 meters, just above the middle was a projection or bulge I saw. What is that? I asked in amazement. These are molds for the upper parts of the sunships. What's on top? It looked like the ship that brought me from the Earth. This is the lid of the mold, look at those holes above. Here the liquid steel is poured into the mold. We kept going. There were different models, the difference was not very big. For some, the lower part was hat-shaped. I probably saw all sorts of other forms of casting, about which I do not want to relate, since I can't TMT explain all this well, as I said before. In the next section I saw grinding machines and planing benches and presses on which the pieces from the foundry were processed. Here I could see quite well, what emerged from these basin-shaped parts, a kind of hat or cap shape, you can call it that, was turned on a lathe. At the lower part of this hat had an opening of about 10 meters. A fixed arm in the middle, a kind of crane, held the shape. And from here this hat shape was ground or rather polished, everywhere fragments broke off. I saw two forms, surely they were upper parts, the other lower parts. Various people worked on these huge machines and perfected the pre-machined hat parts. They had to weigh several tons, because the walls were about 15 centimeters thick with a diameter of 30 meters. Some were already welded together. Into the aforesaid opening was introduced a tank-like container about 3 to 3.2 meters high and 10 meters in diameter. We also saw ready finished craft. Akok and I entered one, as far as I remember, it looked exactly like the ship that had taken me from the Earth. Quiet as a primary school teacher, Akok showed me everything and explained its function. After assembly, it was a single piece, constructed from top, bottom and the inserted tank. Just above the middle line, where the ledge was around the ship, there were 10 powerful solar engines on each side, and inside there were many sections with all sorts of equipment. When I saw the engines with their turbine propellers, I asked, "Do those motors move the ship?" "Yes, they do." I, who knew little or almost nothing of the atmosphere, the ionosphere, or the stratosphere, realized that a propeller plane outside the atmosphere did not produce any recoil. Is it powered above the atmosphere with these motors as well? No, these engines are only used inside the atmosphere, so if you want to fly to another planet, they will only be used to overcome the barriers of attraction. In space, you do not need them anymore. Are they then out of action? No, they are still running, but no longer generate any power. Yes. In which way will a ship move then? In space, these ships move on magnetic waves that are sent out by the planets or ourselves. I'd have to give a lot more explanations about this type of locomotion, but it's completely impossible not because Akok did not explain that to me, but because I believe that anyone who heard me describe this kind of locomotion in space would consider it mere fantasy. Akok showed me everything and explained the function of each part. When we went out again, he pointed to a rectangular tower, about a meter long and 80 centimeters high, which was attached to the dome of the ship. Siva, there's something inside that tower that you cannot look on with the naked eye. Why not? Because it shines in great splendor, seen from close up, this glare would instantly blind a person. What function does this thing have, inside? In itself, it has no function whatsoever. But when the engines inside the ship are set in motion, a kind of vibration is created, and the vibration produces the magnetic waves, similar to those that emanating from the planets. So therefore the smaller mass is attracted by the larger, in this case the spaceship of the planet. And even though it's covered by the dome, Can it work that way? No, this domalid is half pulled back to each side, so the ship can be accelerated. Were you to withdraw this cover completely, the ship at TMS speed would be so great that it would destroy the whole ship. Why can't EMT the ship be propelled in the atmosphere with this system? Because the magnetic beams within the atmosphere all go in one direction, toward the ground, so a landed ship could never rise from the ground. Do you always understand why we need two kinds of systems, one for inside and one out of the atmosphere? I think so. From our current point of view to the end of the factory, everything was full of spaceships and their accessories. We went back and forth. I could not pinpoint exactly how many finished ships were here, but there were a lot. I also asked, are these ships all destined for interplanetary travel? Some of them are equipped for interplanetary travel, such as, for example, the one you just visited. But most of them are for travel from one place to another on Eckhart. Finally, we reached the other end of this huge building and went through a door into the open air. I was relieved that I did not have to hear the click-clack of the steel during its processing. But what I had not heard at all was loud shouts or a conversation among the workers. There were, after all, a few thousand men and a few women employed here. There was complete silence. We were able to overlook a large part of the city from here because the factory was located in a mountain range. I quietly studied the wonder that had been built into the rock. We walked on a cobbled street that ran around the factory. Now I could ask a question that had been on my mind for hours. Everywhere I had been, all the work was electrically powered, but nowhere had I been able to see an electrical connection network. I suspected that this was underground. In order to get rid of the nagging question, I now inquired, where does the electric current that operates the machines, and makes the lamps shine come from? I can see neither wires nor an electric power plant. He laughed and said, on Eckhart, there are no electricity companies. Where does all the energy come from? From up there. He pointed to the sun. So it's RTMS, not just the spaceships powered by solar energy. Many years ago we discovered that solar energy could be used. Since that time we have set aside all other sources of power. Everything you see here, motors, ships, lights, etc. are powered by solar energy from their own generator. Is this solar energy only on Eckhart or on other planets? They exist in our whole solar system. The engines we have here work on every planet of our solar system, with the little difference that the planets orbiting closer around the sun get more energy than the more distant ones. During this conversation, we reached the other side of the factory and boarded an Airbus that ran along the factory. It stopped in the middle of another section of the factory, and we got out. Acock said, I'll show you something now that is also powered by solar energy. Looking in the direction where he indicated, I saw a stone area, but without a building on it. Apparently a subway or a tunnel had been dug. From inside there I saw a small locomotive come out. A locomotive that drew several carriages. It was amazing to see how this train approached the factory, easily moving towards us. After all, the slope was more than 30%. Is the train coming up here? Yes, of course. That's almost impossible. Yes, it is possible. Come on and I'll show you up close. We went to the tracks and now I understood why the locomotive could cope with this slope in the tracks, and wheels were clutches. The motor, which powered the whole thing, was the size of a 2-ton gasoline generator, hauling a load that I estimated at 50 tons. This too is powered by solar energy. Sure, here on Eckhart we do everything with solar energy. What is the cargo of a looks like rock safe ore? Yes, that's ore that is going to be smelted in the factory. Iron ore, steel ore, solar steel. Why is it called solar steel? Because you can only manufacture solar motors out of this solar steel. Do you know if there is solar steel on Earth? According to the research we did there, yes, this material is on Earth. We turned and went back to the factory. He wanted to show me how this ore is smelted. I could not watch exactly how this was done because it was impossible to get close. Acock, however, explained the smelting process to me. We saw several rows of tubes that were 3 meters in diameter and 10 meters long. The raw material entered in there and was smelted by means of an electric current having many thousands of volts, then poured into the molds. I wondered for a long time about nothing more. I felt stunned. I had seen too many new things in too short a time span. I slowly dragged myself forward and had no great desire to learn anything else new. My brain couldn't attempt to cope with any more. I was close to fainting, though that had never happened to me before. When I was able to take in my surroundings again, we stood in front of the elevator, about to ascend to our flying machine. They relieved us of our papers. Leaving the elevator, I sat in the ship and sighed deeply. I was very, very tired. "Where are we going now?" I asked. He looked at his watch and answered, "There is still a tenth left to the next meal. Should we go straight to dinner? Or do you want to see something else?" "You can decide that," I politely said. But I really wanted to have answered him, "I do not want to anything anymore. I'm deathly tired. Please let us leave here." Somehow I could not tell him that, because he seemed so proud to show me everything and obviously enjoyed explaining it all. 15. Defense from an astronomical observatory. He finally decided to leave, and we flew to the surroundings of the mountain town. After a short while we left that populated area behind. In front of me again I saw what looked like a factory chimney. "What's that?" "Have you ever seen a telescope on Earth?"
"Yes, in photographs."
"That's one, and that's where we want to go." As we approached, I saw that it was standing on a high mountain twice as high as the mountains I had seen so far. We climbed higher and landed on a plateau with a funnel-shaped outcrop. The funnel was about 200 meters high, with an opening almost as big as a football field at the top. After we got out, Acock approached a few men close by, showed his pass and talked to them in a friendly way, but when they looked at me, their faces darkened. But I was used to that. I seemed to instill terror in everyone. I wondered what they thought of me. About half a dozen people stood up here, all wrapped up in thick clothes. It was very cold at this altitude. They were probably guards. A flat house, about 10 by 20 meters tall, stood next to the funnel. To the right and to the left of the funnel were two tubes, about 80 centimeters thick and 10 to 12 meters long, a one on each side. Acock confirmed to me later that the people were guards, because here, nobody would choose to reside at this great height. As far as I could tell, the funnel with the two pipes were moved by huge cranes on which large reflectors were attached. Acock asked me, "Do you want to look at the Earth?"
"Of course, but how?"
We went into the house. Acock pointed to a chair and said, "Sit down." He stood at the bottom of the funnel and looked into the eyepiece. At a sign, the huge tower began to tilt about 25% off the horizontal. The guards outside had completed this maneuver. Another hand sign and the tower stood still again. Acock asked me, "Can you find your home continent on a map?"
"Yes, I think so."
"You sure mean South America?"
"Yes, exactly."
"Why?" "Look here," he showed me a spot that offered views on two sides. "And tell me on which planet is the continent you see here?" I looked in and almost uttered a cry. "The Earth, South America." I saw exactly the seas and the continent. I stared in amazement for a long time and then asked, "Why is America so clearly visible, but the rest of the globe shrouded in darkness?" He laughed loudly, which disturbed me a little, and replied, "Do you want the whole globe to be in sunlight? Don't you TMT, you know it's only day on half of the Earth and the other half night?"
"Yes, but I thought you could not tell from here."
"Why not? Especially from this distance you can determine this difference exactly." I looked again and devoted my attention to this fact. I only looked at the South American continent and tried to identify the individual cities, but this was not possible. I was able to distinguish the seas from the continents fairly clearly. I looked very intensively into it, to be able to describe later in detail how I had seen the Earth from up here. With the exception of South America, I could still see a corner of another continent on the bright side, but I could not say which part of the Earth this was, because geography is not exactly my strength. When I had finally seen enough, Acock asked me, "Well, did you like it?" I answered somewhat sadly, "Yes, but I would like it even better if I could take a close look at it and not from this great distance." He said, "I can imagine that."